Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber. This episode of Red Inca, we talk about Ashley Giles with a man who is an expert on him, himself.
Yeah, my name's Ashley Giles and I am Chief Executive Officer at Worcestershire County Cricket Club.
We discuss being a young pace bowler, choosing spin, bowling defensive, Sachin Tendulkar, mental health, imposter syndrome, and the headline, What's the Point of Ashley Giles? But you have a book as well that you forgot to mention. What's your book?
I do, yeah. So now author also. Just released The King of Spain and I, which is the story of my first 37 years, I guess, of being a player. So very focused on my my playing career, some of the struggles within, and my exit from, I suppose, yeah.
And also, you said author, and you did write this book, because I know this for a fact, because I asked George Dobell if he'd written it, because I assumed you would have gone to him. Very disappointed you didn't come to me, but that's fine. And he said, he gave me a bunch of chapters and they were really good. And he's like, why would you need me to write this? So my first question is, what is it like to be a writer?
Incredible. Well, you know, I love a challenge, I suppose. So this was another one of those really big challenges. And I set out writing originally in 2007. So when my wife was first ill, I had a lot of time on my hands. And it was so close, I suppose, to the Ashes of 2005, of course, as well, which the book really focuses in on, my wife's illness. And so I just started writing. And back then I wrote about 50,000 words, which I've obviously gone back over time and edited properly because it was probably just ramblings of a, you know, cricketer. And then, yeah, over the last, whatever that is, yeah, 17, 18 years, I have been editing it. And then we got to last year and George was very kind because I spoke to George. And as you say, he said to me, you don't need me, just get on with it. And then it was Hal. And so George kindly made a introduction to Matt Thacker. We started talking about it and then we decided it was going to be a go, particularly with the 20 years this year of the anniversary of 2005. We pushed the button and then it was sort of, okay, wow, I've got to do this now. and then I spent 6 months over, you know, the back end of last year and this year doing about another 65,000 words. And it was only when, and you've done this, but when you start writing down the chapters and you think, Christ, there's a bit more than I expected. And having a full-time job as well, which I know other writers do, but working for, you know, 9 to 5 all week and then spending my weekends writing, it was hard work, but I wanted to do it. I wanted to get it finished. There was some brilliant editing, of course, by Matt and the team, Phil Walker. So thank you to them. But I'm actually now quite proud of it. It was never, at the time, Jared, it was never really about how many it would sell. It was about doing it and about sharing the story. But now, of course, competitive as we are, yeah, you want it to do really well as well and people to say nice things about it, but yeah, really pleased I got it done.
I really enjoyed it, mate. I did. And also I'm not having a go at ghostwriters here, I've never done it myself, but you know, been asked quite a few times, but it's nice to just be, it's you. It, you know, yeah. I mean, you and I don't know each other particularly well, but like, you know, having listened to you talk a bit, interviewed you a couple of times, had a couple of drinks in random, you know, bars and things, it feels like this is a book by you, you know, about you. And I think that to me makes it a little bit more special than if you just got a newspaper writer to come in and, you know, make sure that there's a couple of headlines in it. And then, as you said, it's very well timed because of the 2005 Ashes. So hopefully it does well. I saw you were part of Phil Brown's photo essay the other day. And so, you know, there's a lot about that sort of stuff going out there at the moment. But this, I'm probably not going to talk to you much about the 2005 Ashes, and I might be the only person you ever talk to that will say that. But I find this a really fascinating book, and you are a fascinating player. Years ago, I interviewed you, I can't even remember how long ago it was, but we were talking about your sort of, your bowling style, and I've always been very fascinated by it. And you start as a fast bowler, right? And there's a few guys, I think, that are a bit like you, you know, left arm finger spinners, sort of bigger, taller, stronger guys as you. Michael Beer started as a fast bowler, Paul Harris. You all end up being defensive finger spinners off the back of that. But the step back is, why did the fast bowling not work? Because you're quite a big guy. Was it just not fast enough, or was it injury, or what sort of happens there?
Yeah, so started with injury. And I was probably just playing too much cricket. So as a 13, 14-year-old, I was playing 70 games a summer. you know, 70 days of cricket as at that age as a seam bowler. Yeah, there was no such thing as workload management. And then I had some back issues, which probably nowadays with diagnostics and the way we are, it would be a stress fracture or something. It would be diagnosed as. But I was told to rest. I was already playing at 14. I was playing first team cricket for Guildford in the Surrey Championship,
which is quite a high level of cricket as well.
Yeah, it's the highest level of club cricket in Surrey. And so they said, "Well, go back to the third team, practice your batting, and when you're fit, come back up." And then in the nets one day, I started bowling, or started walking in and bowling just a few little left arm things. Didn't hurt my back, and it just kept me busy. And then that Saturday, we were getting battered around the park a bit, I think. And the captain said to me, "You know, would you bowl some of that stuff you bowl the nets if you're okay?" And I went, "Absolutely." You know, just wanted to get into it, and I got 6 wickets. And in 4 weeks, I got 21 wickets, and I loved it, you know, because as a bowler, the last thing you want to do is just stand in the outfield. You want to be involved. And then they said, "Well, if it's going that well, why don't you go and play in the second team and bat in the middle order and bowl some spin?" And that's how it started to build. And at one point I went back to the first team when I was fit and I was opening the bowling, and then the captain was coming to me and saying, "Right, time to bowl spin now." And there would have been matches where I bowled the whole innings straight through from one end. And then the real complication was Surrey. Surrey didn't want me to bowl spin anymore. They'd always groomed me as this left-arm seamer. I'd had lots of extra attention. I'd done really well for the pathway. I stopped for a while, and it wasn't going very well. And there was a pivotal day when Chris Waller, the second team coach at the time, came to watch me at Guildford. And I hadn't been bowling spin. And then the captain came to me after bowling probably 3 average overs a seam and saying, "I need you to bowl spin. What will you do?" And I actually went off the field and I had to speak to my dad. I spoke to the guy who was like key coaching my sort of youth, Brian Ruby. Brian said, "Just get on with it and do it." He was with a few expletives. and my dad said, "Do what you think's right." And I just thought, team needs me to bowl, I'm going to bowl. And I bowled the rest of the innings off spin. And I think at that point, probably knew, as Chris Waller sat there for the rest of the match and watched it, that was probably the end of my chances at Surrey.
that's quite a big decision to make, isn't it?
Yeah, it was huge. I mean, on the other side of it, yeah, I mean, it was a huge decision for whatever I was, 17-year-old at the time, 16, 17-year-old. But, you know, it's transformed everything, really. You know, I wouldn't have had the experiences, the career. I wouldn't be sitting here right now talking to you, wouldn't have met my wife. So a bit sliding doors moment, but in the end, turned out okay. Although, you know, there were times when it, as for all of us, it looked like it wouldn't.
Being a seamer, you talk about a bit in the book of it kind of helps your mindset as a spinner. So, you know, a lot of people, when they become international spinners, I'd say 85% are probably always spinners. And then you have that 15% that change through to injury, or they're not quick enough, or whatever it may be. How did being a seamer help you when you started bowling spin? How did it help your thought process?
Well, as a seamer, so I mean, as a young seamer, I think I had a bit of pace, but then I was really accurate. I think I had really good basics and strong foundations. So I just think those strong foundations in your action are really important, give you a really strong base to work from. And I always say, you know, under pressure, that's what you fall back on. You see a lot of schoolboy spinners, very, you know, jumpy, short actions, all looks a bit fast. And I think those of us who've come through as seamers actually have the complete opposite. We're quite long, quite, you know, solid at the crease, long levers. And I think that helped me amazing. So, people would say throughout my whole career, I didn't spin it a lot, but I had control. And I had, you know, I had that accuracy, obviously had height and bounce, which is, I think, really important. You've got to have, you know, there's got to be variations, and variations are different. Yes, of course, the spin. And I think I did spin it. I took the mickey out of myself, but in the right conditions, I spun it. Had to be helpful, perhaps. But you've got drift, you've got bounce, you've got pace. they're also really important variations. And at my best, I hope I utilize those things as much as spin.
I assume, and actually I know this because I think we've talked about it before, but when you started, you talked about it a minute ago, you took 21 wickets in the first few games, but you're an attacking finger spinner, right? You come through the system. When's the first time that teams start to use you more defensively and more as a holding bowler?
I don't know. I could say I just grew into the role. I've always been one who I think I've done whatever the team has required of me in any given situation. So in the book, I talk about, you know, the Sachin moment, for example, in Bangalore, where he was stumped for the first time and only time in Test cricket. And it wasn't some great master plan that Nas Hussain, Fletch and I devised. It was just a means of keeping the best player in the world quiet. And while the stuff in the middle of the pitch was good to bat on, we needed to find a way. Actually, while we were also taking wickets the other end with pace, needed to find a way to keep control. And it wasn't necessarily pretty. It's not necessarily the only way, but it was effective on that occasion. And I think, you know, the game is about finding a way to win at times. Was never meant to be disrespectful to the, as I say, one of the greatest players ever played the game. And was it effective? Well, in that moment it was, but he still got 90. It wasn't as though we, you know, robbed him. But in the match situation, although the last day got rained off, could have been a really good match because we ended up carrying a lead into that second innings. And that ultimately is what it's about. It's trying to find a way to win games. But, you know, when I reflect on my early career at Warwickshire, breaking into the team, yeah, I think I really was an attacking bowler. I think in reflection also, and this is where I found the book really helpful and very cathartic, actually, is even looking at my injury that ended up finishing my career, I think there came a point, even a couple of years before that, where it became harder and harder for me to bowl hard around the wicket. Because I was quite wide on the crease, so quite crossed over, that journey back from there to bowl to right-handers.
You mean like the twisting around your hip? Yeah.
Yeah, that torsion on my hip, I didn't really understand at the time, but probably became harder and harder, and I became less consistent. Whereas, of course, bowling over the wicket, you're bowling almost more over that front leg. And I think that was probably a factor. I got my dad to thank for that. He had both of his hips replaced, and apparently there's a little bit of genetics there. But you know, I won't blame him for too much. I do think that was also a bit of a factor.
Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. It's really interesting. There's actually a book out at the moment called Ballistic, which is all about professional athletes. It's mostly about basketball, but the whole book is about hips. And when I was reading your book, I was like, this is the sort of stuff that and it's not just, you know, we've had a couple of spinners of recent times with hips and groin issues, and that's the sort of thing that the book is talking about. So I find it fascinating. Just the mental side of it, though. Obviously, you get the success with Sachin Tendulkar. You do start to bowl. We don't have as much stats, but it does feel anecdotally like you start to bowl over the wicket more as a sort of a holding bowler. Let's be honest. You grew up as a fast bowler, and then you're an attacking spinner. No one grows up, Jilo, wanting to be a holding spinner, right? Let's just no one when they're dreaming in their bed. Is there any point where you're just like, it would be great if I could do this or whatever? Or is at that point, are you just thinking, no, this is what the team needs and this is what I am and I can be a really important cog in the team?
Yeah, look, I think there's that. I guess, yeah, in reflection, you look back and go, well, could have there been times when I could have pushed that envelope a bit more and been a bit less boring Ashley Giles and been a bit more attacking? But I suppose in many ways, more than my hair, I've always been the grey man. I've tried to be the solid, consistent citizen, what the team requires of me. But also, actually, when conditions did suit, you know, I had I think I still hold the record for England bowler in three tests in Pakistan.
Mm.
And I probably equal record in Sri Lanka. So when conditions did suit, I could show I could be attacking and I got wickets. But the conditions at times in England and the situation at times in England required me to play a different role, which was probably never more true than in that 2005 Ashes. But yeah, 2004 was my most successful summer at home. I got 24 wickets in the summer at 26 or something like that. I'm sort of guessing, but really successful. A lot of that was over the wicket, and I think sometimes wrongly the perception was that when I bowled over the wicket, I always bowled out into the rough. I didn't.
Yeah. No.
I tried to bowl straight, and it's something Duncan Fletcher and I talked about a lot, was that off spinners often bowled over the wicket in towards leg, middle and leg, and didn't get any criticism for it. But because I did it, it was different. Of course, there were times when you had to go wide. Sachin's was the best example. I'm not going to deny that. That was trying to hide it. But it was rare that I bowled that wide.
I would say that you were probably more like someone like Paul Harris, where you bowled that sort of leg stump or just outside leg stump line more often than not, which is, it's something that we see quite often with sort of Western left arm finger spinners when they're trying to hold the game. But it's not as if you were bowling to not go for any runs or not take any. Sorry, I should say that again. It's not that you're bowling to not take any wickets. As you said, you're not bowling that you know, miles outside leg stump, which occasionally you did as well. It's more something else. But I wonder if there isn't also, because of the height that you had, you're probably bringing in short leg a little bit more in that position and everything else. So maybe there was a technical reason with your bowling that made sense to do that. And on top of that, there is an element of finger spinners in South Africa and Australia and New Zealand, these sorts of players, are more holding bowlers naturally because the conditions don't allow you to attack as often.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think I naturally sort of got drift into right-hander from that straight line over the wicket. So actually I like to think anyway, maybe I'm wrong. In the modern game, I hit an awful lot of people on the pads from sort of leg stump, middle and leg, that bringing DRS in nowadays would have been much more interesting. But yeah, it was two things, utilising what I've got, but always doing what was best for the team. And I think 2005, again, there's a moment in the book I talk about how tough the post-Lords, the post-first test match was for me. I had a real battle with the media, which was stupid. And I should have just kept my mouth shut, but one of the things that brought me out of that was a comment that John Buchanan made in the media when he said, and I thought I was just, you know, useless through that week. You know, started to believe that negative stuff again. And he came out and said, look, if we can get to Ashley Giles, we know we can get to the rest of them. And then it actually gave me purpose and a reason. And if I'm doing my job and I'm doing it really well, even if at times that is just holding an end and allowing our big four to get through and rotate, and that's good enough for me, because if that ultimately helps us win in the Ashes, then I'm doing my bit.
There's also an element of that, essentially, in those conditions, if you can go at three runs and over, right, and you can rest all those fast bowlers, that you don't really want to be in a situation where you might go at 3.5 runs and over, and, you know, and Australia gets on top of you and Hayden starts sweeping you, and, you know, whatever that may be. So you... Again, you talk about being the grey man, like you are very malleable in that kind of way of being able to do it. The problem with all this, as you are more than aware of anyone else, is people don't really understand that from outside of cricket. And the English media at that time was very sort of, I'm trying to think of the exact words, they were just like, they were very pithy and very, everyone was trying to write the line that everyone would remember at all times. Like you go, the Old Trafford press box has like a bunch of these really pissing lines that that English writers have written about players, and you're like, yeah, these aren't really good things to be focusing on if you're in the media. And you know, you become, I can't remember who it was, but you become the wheelie bin right? Like, you know, everyone's trying to like come up with that. You know that you're doing a job, and Duncan Fletcher knows you're doing a job, and Michael Vaughan knows you're doing a job, but they don't really do a great way of selling that. And the English media is kind of using you as the weakest player in that side, despite the fact that the team's actually doing really well when you're there. Like it's an odd juxtaposition, and you're, as a professional athlete, trying to work your way through this. And you're not, you talk about it openly in the book, you're not always that confident, right? There are times when you doubt yourself. That must be really hard to be, you know, the main person in the English media's mind when there's like 9 newspapers and each writer's trying to come up with the best insult for you.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. And it, you know, when you, and I talk about being scrambled quite a lot, and I think it's that balance between which voices you're listening to. So you're quite right. Mm. So I had the support of my teammates, my coach, my captain. I had a very supporting network around me, my family. But then you start listening and reading to the other stuff, and this other stuff in your head goes quiet. So it doesn't matter what people around you say, or you can, you start to become this character that everyone else is writing about and talking about that is not very good. Why is he in the team? Well, he's only in the team because he's the only spinner available. He, you know, oh, poor old Gilo, you know, it all of that. And it really started to get under my skin. And that sort of 2003-04 period was incredibly tough. And I know that people go through a lot worse than what I talk about in the book. But I wanted to talk about it openly because yet those feelings are still, they're there. They're there in, you know, they're there for everyone, whether you're, you know, this left arm spinner playing for England or someone, you know, working down the road in the high street or whatever. It's those feelings are real. And I think we all get to that place sometimes that, again, is a bit scrambled, and your attention is on the stuff, the negative stuff, or the stuff you can't control, or the stuff you can't have an effect on. And that is very normal for everyone. That's not, you know, again, I don't have a monopoly on that. That's not why I've written about it in the book, poor me. It's just, it is okay to talk about this stuff. And if I found anything from the book, the cathartic nature of not only writing the book, but then releasing it. So actually then, you know, writing it's one thing because it's yours still. You can keep it like this. But once you've released it, everyone's got, you know, a view on it or eyes on it or, you know, you definitely bare your soul a little bit. But I found that as cathartic as anything because it's okay. This is me. Mm. And for quite some time, as I say in the book, I think I've reflected really negatively on parts of my career. Almost, again, listened to too much of that. The noise. But now actually I go, how incredibly lucky and privileged and how much fun it was. You know, yes, there's some bad times in there, but you know, that kid that started that journey on the village green, wanting to play cricket for a living, wanting to play for England, and almost to finish, not quite, but to finish in 2005 at the Oval. That's a pretty special journey. And you know, again, the word I use a lot is I just feel really privileged to have been part of that.
One of the things that it's really interesting because I think you're fairly well known in cricket as being quite level-headed and maybe pragmatic. Like that's, you know, there are players who blow hot and cold and coaches and directors. I won't go through all your job titles, mate. You've had it more than I have. But, you know, you're known as being, you know, quite level. It's interesting going through the book. Obviously, depression is something that a lot of international athletes have and we understand. But imposter syndrome is something else that you kind of hint at quite a lot. And I think you said something there where you're just like, I was the only spinner available. And I think if you're beating, if Phil Tufnell was still playing and you beat him off, to get him into the side, right? And, you know, Swanee was in his peak and there's an element of like, these other guys are really good and I know they're really good and I could see them and I can beat them and I'm in the side ahead of them. But there's an element of, it's really hard for you when you're like, there are certain series where the opposition spinner is, I don't know, Murali or Shane Warne, right? And you can't not look at those people and think that there is, you know, there isn't a comparison there. So imposter syndrome is something that's really hard. When does that kind of, because it feels like there's a point in your life where you kind of let all that go, right? And you just sort of move on.
Yeah. So it was about that 2003 summer, towards the back end, and then into the beginning of 2004, including the West Indies tour, I just got into a really bad, bad place where it was, I'm not good enough. Why am I here? Why do I bother? I felt I was letting my family down. When I was with my family, I felt I should be practicing. You know, that balance was completely lost. And I was just zeroed in on this bowler, this character that everyone had created that was, again, this, he's not really good enough, but he'll do. He's a good bloke. He's solid. And Steve Bull actually started pulling me out of that. Steve Bull's our sports psychologist with England. And he actually, rather than this isolated bowler that everyone talked about, really got me to look at my broad role for the team as much as anything as well, and all the other stuff I did. So, yeah, as you say, I hope I was really solid in the dressing room, good citizen. I think I caught well in Gully. I was a decent fielder, and I could get some useful runs down the order as well. So once you start to look at that role, I felt a bit better about what I was doing, and started to place my focus a lot more on me and actually the good things I'd done. So you mentioned Phil Tufnell. In that conversation with Bully, I talked about Tuffers, and I love watching Tuffers bowl because he was the classical on a bit of string, up and down, you know, get it to drop, cheeky chappy. So many spinners seem to be a bit off the wall, and I'm not.
You don't fit in with them at all.
No. So there was all that, and I never imagined that I would get more test wickets than Phil Tufnell at that point. And within actually a few test matches, I'd sort of gone past him. And that's not about me being better than Phil Tufnell, but that's just, okay, you know, I can belong. I can do a job. That job won't be the same as Phil Tufnell, but it can be equally as important, if not better, in other places. And it was about the same time I started writing in that journal I talk about as well. So clearly, you know, I've talked about writing the book and how cathartic that is. That's almost the effect that having I suppose what you'd call a daily performance journal had on me as well. It's almost like getting it from here onto a piece of paper really helped me. I've not always been the best talker about emotions, but writing it, I found much easier, and it's almost released that burden. So that then, there was an element of sod it, get on with it, but there was an element actually of putting those things in place that made a massive difference, because actually it was about that time, in fact, a few days later, and we're playing a test match at Trent Bridge against New Zealand, when there was a headline on the back of the paper that said, "What's the point of Ashley Giles?" You know, probably 2 weeks earlier, I think I probably would have cried sitting there, you know, the state I was in. But I just sort of laughed at it to myself, and let it go, moved on, because I just realigned my thinking back to, right, what's my value to the team? What's my job today? What do I have to do? You know, what's the good stuff I can deliver? The change was almost immediate.
That was the first chapter I read, and I think I got the PDF from the publishers, and Sam Stowe had sent it through to me, and I was like, you know, going through the chapters, because I wanted to see what kind of book it was. I wanted to see what you'd written, and I saw that. I went to it, and I was almost disappointed, mate, because you handled it so well. I mean, the idea that you've lived a life and someone has written on an English newspaper, "What's the point of Ashley Giles?" But by that stage, because you had sort of understood it, it's a huge thing, and that's probably shows why you were able to handle that kind of pressure, even if at times it was tougher, is that by the time you have flipped that switch and you understand who you are, it doesn't really matter what anyone writes about you. Again, I remember, I won't name the player, but I remember I was trying to talk to this player about this initiative he was working with. And he was an English player from a couple of generations earlier than you. And we were at a press event, and I was trying to talk to him about this thing. And he couldn't stop moaning about all the people in the press. This guy wrote this about me, and this guy wrote... This was 25 years on, and he couldn't get over it. So for you, within the space of a couple of weeks, to get maybe one of the worst headlines any human being's had about them and be able to handle it, I think it's a remarkable thing, mate.
Yeah, I mean, it's... And it's not as though there weren't times after that that I've not struggled again. You know, whether that be as... England head coach, England managing director. There were some really tough times, and there were tough times during those periods for, particularly the COVID period for all of us. But yeah, I'm also able to talk about how I reflect now. And again, this is, I'm really not trying to blow my own trumpet, but I do think I'm incredibly resilient, because I think, and George has even joked about it with me in the past, you know, you do one job, you get moved on, you do another job, you moved on, and you come back again and you just want more. And I think he said something like, it's like a boiling hot water, kettle of water for ants. He said, that's the only thing that's going to get, see you off at some point, something like that. And but I take that as a great compliment, because actually life is about dusting yourself down and getting up and going again. There's no option, you know, there's no point in hiding under the table. And I know some people struggle to get out of bed daily, but that is, you know, that's one of the things I take greatest pride in. And I hope I demonstrate to my kids as much as anything, is that adversity is real. It's present for everyone, but there's no other way than to get up and keep sort of leaning into it. And eventually, you know, it doesn't always work out the way you want it to, but it's a great characteristic to have, to be able to do that. And I think that's probably what I'm proudest of.
Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today. I mean, I remember when you were given, I don't want to say a poison chalice, because it's the wrong way of looking at it, but I remember when you were in charge of the limited overs team, and there was different, the coaching structure and everything. And I think the idea of having a limited overs coach and a Red Bull coach made sense, but there probably wasn't the structure around it to back you up at that stage.
Mm.
It could have been a situation, I think about all these different times in your life when you could have actually just gone off and taken a job at a lovely school in England and taught a bunch of kids and been fine. There is a competitive, and I remember watching you bowl, there's a competitive nature to you, right? That is sort of, as you say, that it's almost like you like it being a little bit tough, and you're going to try and battle that through. And if you look at you're going to be a fast bowler, you know, you're combative against Surrey at a certain point, you know, all the way through. It feels like you've always been fighting for these little moments. You know, that is just a part of who Ashley Giles is, right?
Yeah, and that, you know, when I am asked to speak to businesses or otherwise, one of the things I say is that failure is inevitable, you know, and get comfortable with that concept, because if you put yourself out there, you are going to fail. You know, otherwise, the only thing to do is to live, you know, that quite quiet life where there are no highs and lows, there's no winning and losing, and that's not really real for anyone. So you have to be comfortable with, you know, whatever successes I've had, and I've had, I think, probably more than most in that career. I've still had probably as many, if not more, bad days where you do doubt, you have self-doubt, you wonder, you know, the criticism, the papers. But going back to your original point, you know, when I first looked like retiring, and I did a little bit of stuff for the radio, I did a little bit of stuff for Sky, and it's great. Absolutely love it. But I didn't have that same high and low. And I know no one should really desire those real low moments that you suffer. But I see that as living as well. I see that as, you know, I'd rather have a bad day at the office than nothing. Because with the bad days come the good days. You know what I mean? It's that balance. And that's the life working in these environments that you live, and working with these sort of teams that you live. You don't always like it. But I've also always been, I think, and sometimes I've called it unhealthily ambitious because of that. You sort of always throwing yourself back into the fight. But I am ambitious. I think it's not absolutely the cost of anyone else. I've never had that in me at all. But to be better, to prove people wrong, to achieve, to make my mum and dad proud, to make my family proud. I think it's all that is the legacy piece has always been really important to me. The what you leave behind better than what you took on, and that's not always possible. Doesn't always work out like the fairy tale, but you know, I've often been the sort of custodian, and I think we all are, like I am right now at Worcestershire. I'm a custodian of a great club that's been around for hundreds of years. And that's the same when you work for England, for Warwickshire, whatever role, and your responsibility in that moment is you know, it's yours, and you've got to do the very best you can for it. And I always take that very seriously. And it's only when people question that bit that I actually get quite antsy. It's just like, do not question my, even, you know, my values, because this is, you know, I take that bit so seriously.
Is this part of the reason why, I mean, if you look at your career, you're probably not quite an all-rounder, but you're like all-rounder adjacent, at least, especially at the international level. But you can certainly bat and, you know, hang around and do things. You're a very good fielder, especially for a bowler. No offense to all the bowlers out there, but you'd be in the top percentage of fielders you could bowl, and in multiple positions. I know you're maybe a gully specialist, but you're a very good outfielder as well. And obviously you're bowling. It feels like you were always trying to improve in all different facets all the way through. Was that a conscious thing? Because eventually you come up through Warwickshire, which is, you know, you would have had access to people like Bob Woolmer and Dermot Reeve and, you know, cricket geniuses. Or is that just who you are as a person, where it's just like, no, if I'm going to be sitting in the field, I want to be of use in the field. You know, if I'm going to bat at number eight, I want to be a handy number eight. Is that kind of how you look at it?
Yeah. I mean, I guess in many ways I just loved it, because there was a bit of badger about me, even like throwing every morning. I'd understand why some don't do it now. You know, I used to throw every morning to practice my arm, to keep my arm in, you know. And so we'd go out with mitts every morning. We'd throw short distance, long distance at stumps. And that was just a way of constant improvement. A bit of that is just being a badger and just loving what you do. So yeah, being that kid still on the village green, just running around, catching, playing, throwing, hitting. It was just a dream job. But the environment I fell into at Warwickshire in the early 90s was clearly, you know, I was very lucky. You know, Surrey didn't want me, but landed on my feet absolutely in that environment, where it was about expression and challenge and getting better. And, you know, Dermot was a fantastic leader, and Bob Woolmer, one of the best two coaches I ever worked with, you know, the other being Duncan, of course, but both technical geniuses. A bit boring almost, in the, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, but it was just only ever about improving the game and how could we change cricket and what does that look like. And so again, those sliding door moments where you meet people or you come into contact with people that change the direction of your career, and I thank all of them, because again, no one's born leader, manager, CEO, coach. But I think a bit like being the cricket badger, I use that term again, but that person loves the game, almost being that sponge of all those people around you. I came into contact with so many good people across the game. Brian Lara, Alan Donald, Sean Pollock, Dermot Reeve, Tim Munton, Glasson Small, then all the England players I played with, all those players I played against, and all the coaches. And you pick up the stuff you like and you think works well for teams, and then the stuff you see that you're like, oh my God, no, why did you say that? Because, you know, that's just put the dressing room on shutdown, or, you know, watching that interaction with a player that doesn't work. And I think I've been hopefully good at mixing through that stuff and using it, because, you know, the young lad, again, that came through George Abbott, secondary comp near Guildford, never imagined being a leader at this level, but it's only through those environments and through those experiences that I've been able to get here.
So much of your legacy is linked to 2005. And I know that, you know, I mean, a lot of this book is based on it. And over the last couple of weeks, you would have been called by radio stations to come in and tell us the stories and everything. But your career is a lot bigger than that. And I kind of wondered, is what's the thing, or sort of the other individual moment where you were like, I wish people would remember this. You know, you know why they don't. You know why 2005 is 2005. But for you personally, was there another moment or a series, or, you know, might have been a spell, or, you know, a summer where you go, I wish they could also remember this as long, you know, along with 2005 when they talk about me.
Yeah, look, I think 2004, I've mentioned, is my best domestic summer. And given where I started that summer, which is pretty much at a point of despair and possibly walking away from the game, that was huge. And I just loved every moment of it, because once I got into it, you know, that last test against New Zealand and then the West Indies series, I was a completely different beast and just had this bounce and confidence got runs and wickets. But I think also those moments I talked about earlier in Sri Lanka, Pakistan, where I bowled it hard, I spun it, and I put some of the best players in the world under pressure. So I think sometimes that's lost in this defensive bowler that you talk about, which absolutely was a role that I played at times. But I think sometimes people forget that I could do that stuff as well. And I won't say mix it with the best of them, because as you said, I was up against Murali, Shane Warne, who are not just generational bowlers. They are all-time legends of the game. But again, I use that word privilege of being on the same field as them and being able to go against them, even if it's me with my seam bowling mates against one of them rather than just me against them.
The book is called The King of Spain and I won't explain The King of Spain. Any fan of Warwickshire will know exactly what that is. Everyone else can buy the book and work it out themselves. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Huge pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.